One of the things that I think Fuller does well, and from everything I've heard about Terry and Sharon, is it taking the best of social science and theology, the Bible, right? Instead of thinking, you know, well, the Bible tells you how to live and we don't need to pay attention to what research says. We don't need to pay attention to therapy and that kind of thing. It's really taking the best of social science and saying, you know, how is this true in terms of who God made us to be? Looking at the Bible, looking at Jesus and creation and all of the things that teach us about God's plan for us in the Bible. So I'm excited that we're doing that. And let's open with a prayer. Gracious God, we thank you for the gift of marriage. We thank you for coming up with this plan of putting us together in families, of bringing us together so that we don't have to be alone. And we thank you for the witness that we experience of your love and the reality of who you are through the love of another person. And I pray that today you will open our minds and open our hearts, that we can hear more about who we were made to be and who we can be in our relationships, how love can heal our deepest wounds and how we can heal each other. I pray that you will work in all of the relationships that are represented in this room, and even the ones that aren't here, the friends that we talk to next week and share the insights that we've gained, that you'll bring healing to us and through us to a world in deep need. I pray that the light of your face will shine on us in this room through the next few hours. In Jesus' name, amen.
Thank y'all for coming tonight. We're excited about what we have to share to you. I was thinking, while I was kind of sitting listening to Amy talk, Sharon and I have known each other a long time. First of all, this is our 35th year of marriage, right? But, that's cool. But it's not only that we've been married 35 years, we met in eighth grade English. So we've actually known each other for 44 years of our 57 years that we've been alive. So we've been hanging around each other a lot. And so some of the ways that we think about relationships have been hammered out over a long-term period. We've really been working at this for a long time. I have a lot of passion about marriage, primarily because it teaches us so much about who we are as individuals and where we need to grow. You know, if you're looking for the spiritual application of marriage, then I would like to propose to you that it's that thing. It's to point out who you are and also point out the area where you really need to grow. That's what God keeps on impressing upon me over and over again in my life, is that he wants to get to know me. He wants me to certainly flourish, but he also has an expectation that I grow in the midst of that kind of idea. Well, one of the things that we want to say is that, you know, a lot of times, a lot of marriage seminars, and we don't have anything against these seminars per se, but they have you over-focus on how males and females are different, all right? And we want you to know that we do think males and females are different, okay? But here's the main deal, is that males and females are much more alike than they are like anything else in the world. And that part that we're alike puts us both in the same category that we both need to start flourishing and growing. Hopefully you'll see a way to do that in your marriage. Hopefully you'll see the way to do that in your spirituality as we go along tonight.
Great. 34 years of marriage. You know, the thing that I like about marriage more than anything is that I truly believe that my marriage has made me better. It's made me a better individual. It's made me a better person. It's made me a better parent. It's made me a better employee. And that's a little bit of the vision that we hope to share with you guys tonight, is a vision of how marriage can make us better. You know, Scripture tells us a verse that you all know, a verse that you've read a million times, but a verse I have to read again because I love it so much, is in Genesis. It says, "Then the man said, 'This is now bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh.'" Genesis 2. "She shall be called woman because she was taken out of man. Therefore a man shall leave his father and his mother and hold fast to his wife, and they shall become one flesh. And the man and his wife were both naked," or in Texan, they're naked, "naked and not ashamed." You know, it's an interesting thing. A great privilege for us this year is that both of our children married last year. Hallie Ann and Matt married in August, and then our son married in November. So it was a big year of weddings. But if you think of a wedding, and I don't know how many of you got married. You probably got married in a lot of different ways, but somewhat like how Terry and I got married, is that there was, well, how we got married is I was in white and he was in black, and I was at the back of the church and he was at the front of the church. And then we got to the church and I walked down the aisle to him and we looked at each other and we said a few words and we committed our lives to each other. And we turned around and we walked back up the aisle, and we were still two people. Scripture tells us that we get married and two people become one flesh. But, you know, we still had two different jobs, two different sets of friends, two different ways to clean the toilet, right? Two different ways. Yeah. I clean it much quicker than Terry does. Anyway, we both. Were these still two people that had done things so differently? And what does it mean? What does it mean when two people become one flesh? Because Scripture tells us that. And so we began to play around with that, and we went to school, and we got our master's in marriage and family therapy, and we got our doctorate, or Terry got his doctorate in marriage and family therapy, and we still weren't really quite sure what it meant for two people to become one flesh. We'd talk about contracts, you'd talk about covenants, we'd talk about all kinds of things, but we really weren't sure what it meant for two people to become one. And then Terry had the opportunity to eat breakfast one day with a man by the name of Carl Whitaker. And if any of you are marriage and family therapists, you would know that Carl Whitaker was one of the founding fathers in the field of marriage and family therapy. Carl was kind of a strange guy. He was what called an experiential therapist. And so he would do things like fall asleep on his clients to see what would happen if he fell asleep in the middle of session, and then talk to the family about how they handled that. So Terry wasn't surprised that conversation with Carl was a little random and very not a whole lot connected. But at one point, Carl looked at him in the middle of breakfast and he said, "You know, Terry," he said, "when Muriel dies," and Muriel was his wife of 53 years at that time, he said, "I will miss her. But more than missing her, I will miss who we are together." Somehow, Terry came home from that breakfast and he said, "You know, Carl said this thing to me, and this made more sense to me than anything I've ever thought about in what marriage looks like." And I know a lot of you have been to a lot of marriage seminars and you've seen a lot of circles on marriage and circles on oneness, and sometimes the circles interact and sometimes they don't, but I'm going to draw the Hargrave circles for you, okay? In our particular marriage, what we believe that in our marriage, there's Sharon and there's Terry. And then between us is this indivisible entity called us. You see, I like Sunday afternoon at home. I like a good Sunday afternoon nap. I don't particularly like eating in restaurants. I'm ready to go home. However, you come up to Terry after church on Sundays that we're going to do. It's based on a lot of things. It's based on how much money we have in the bank, how many times we've eaten out that week, how much we have to get done that afternoon, how much we like the people that have invited us. True. So us sometimes goes out to eat and us sometimes doesn't. Now here's the beginning of the really amazing part to me about marriage is, us needs to go out to eat with other people at church sometimes on Sunday. Because when you go out to eat with people after church on Sunday, you get to know them in a totally new and different way. You get to meet their kids. You get to spend time with them just over fellowship. And it's a good thing. But you know what? Us sometimes needs to go home after church on Sunday because us is tired sometimes or we've had too busy of a week or something like that. So I have grown and learned and connected to people because of how we do that. And Terry's grown and learned and connected in the other way. Parenting is another example. And Hallie Ann can attest to this. I don't know if she remembers as much, but I remember when my kids, Hallie Ann was 6 and Peter was 4. And I remember that I began to realize that when Terry got home, which was about 5:30 in the afternoon, as parents of young children, we called that the happy hour. You know, when you're wanting to hang somebody from the closest rafter because they're screaming and whining, and began to realize that Terry would come in and he would restore order, which was nice for a while until I realized that we were developing the good cop, bad cop parenting, right? Okay, you know, well, let me tell you the reason my kids were whining. It's because every time they would whine, I would give them what they wanted, and so it worked, right? So the more I gave them what they wanted when they whined, the more they whined, then Terry would come home and he would restore order. So I was the sort of nurturing, nice guy parent, and he was the disciplinarian, these kids need to learn how to behave correctly parent. And we looked at each other and we thought, we don't like how this is turning out. We don't want to be the good cop, bad cop parent. So we developed a new system whereby when Terry would walk in the door and the kids were whining because they'd gotten the best of me, he would kind of pull me aside and say, you know, I think you've maybe given them too much of what they wanted. And so I began to realize that as a parent, I needed to step back into the role of being more disciplinarian and being a little bit tougher. And you know what that allowed Terry to do? Be a little bit more nurturing, be a little bit more nicer. So then what we hoped our kids got, and you can verify this later, but was two good parents that both knew how to nurture and both knew how to discipline. So being married to Terry, if I had raised my children, they would not be near the people that they are today because of his desire for them to learn responsibility and learn how to do things. My desire was to make sure they felt good all the time. Both desires are good. But if you just have one without the other, it's not near as powerful. You see, what happens with marriage is marriage can be considered, when you get married, it can first come off kind of like it's a competition. It's, are we going to do it my way or are we going to do it your way? Who's right? I'm right. You're right. You know, who's right? Who's wrong? And sometimes that right-wrong thing can turn into arguments, and so then we hire therapists, right? We go to marriage and family therapy. And marriage and family therapists teach us this whole world word called compromise, and we supposedly learn how to, well, honestly, what Terry and I think is we learn how to compete nicely. Because there's still some tracking going on of, well, we did it your way last time, so we need to do it my way this time. So, you know, you kind of go back and forth on that. So what we really want to do, instead of competing, instead of marriage being a competition, instead of learning how to compromise, what we really want to do is we want our marriages to look like two people that are working together in cooperation. Because if you go back to my two examples of whether you're looking at going out to church or not going out to after dinner to church, we become better people. We cooperate together to decide what's the best thing for us to do on this day, given these circumstances, what's the best for us? And then in parenting, what's the best not only for us, but what's the best for the child? So it doesn't get into a competition of who's right and who's wrong. It's what's for the best of the relationship. And the best of this relationship is the fact, honestly, that you sacrifice for it and you learn how to grow and live from it. It's kind of like a child. You know, if you take your child and you feed them and you nurture them and everything, they grow up. If you don't do those things, they wither up and die. That's exactly what this marriage relationship is like. It's like a child that you need to feed and you need to nurture. You know, I've never woken up in the morning when I had children at home and said, you know, Terry, what do you think we ought to feed the kids today? It's never been a question on my mind. So part of what we're going to be talking about tonight is the whole idea of how do we nurture this oneness or this usness that exists between us.
Yeah, and Sharon really said it, right? Taking care of your marriage is going to be more like taking care of children than it is of anything else. In other words, it's like good parenting. Because what you're really after is thinking about not, you know, when you take care of children, you're not thinking, you know, I'm, you know, what's going to be good for me? You're not thinking that as a parent. You're usually thinking of what's in the best interest of the child. What's in the best interest of the child? If you have an us relationship with your spouse, then what you're doing is you're starting to look out for what's the best thing for our marriage. What's the best thing for our usness versus what's the best thing for me? What's the best thing for Sharon? Does that make sense? Yeah, all right, so that's where we are. So, you know, so where do we go wrong? Where do we get off base, if you will, in this framework of marriage? You know, I would love to say, we've been at this a long time as studying marriage and dealing with couples. I would love to say that the problem of your marriage is your spouse. You know, it's her that's driving me crazy. You know, if she would just stop, I'd be better. Or if she could say the same. If he would just start, then we'd be better, right? You know, I get that. The problem is that, you know, most of your issues that you're fighting out with your spouse didn't start with your spouse. Most often they started somewhere else. You know, what we think is that there's basically two elements that are absolutely essential in human condition. In human relationships, we focus on these two things: love and trustworthiness. Love is such a great thing because it teaches you about who you are. It teaches you about your identity. The only way that you know who you are is the way that people loved you. If you were a young child and people scooped you up in their arm and said, "Oh, you know, I just can't believe I'm so lucky I have you," then chances are you probably grew up and you thought, "You are lucky to have me, you know? I am special, you know?" That sense of excitement that teaches you that you're unique, that you are absolutely special. There's only one of you. You know, if you grew up around people that's like they started recognizing, man, you got game here. You've got gifts. You've got talents that I don't have, that your mother doesn't have. You are really an interesting person. Tell me more. Tell me what you think. You know, in other words, they engage you on this kind of like a friendship level. You know, those of you that have friends that have been lifelong, you know, if you haven't seen them for a while, maybe gone a long time without seeing them, maybe a year, maybe 6 months, maybe even longer, maybe 5 years. When you get back together with them, where do you start? Right where you left off. You don't go back to the beginning. It's like, oh, yeah, we know each other. In fact, when you have that kind of friendship with somebody, it's like you've never been alone, right? That's what this kind of love where it's like, I like just being around you. You always carry them in your heart a little bit. And then there's this kind of love that's saying, I'm willing to go to the mat for you. I'm willing to sacrifice for you. In fact, I'm willing to sacrifice what I need for something that you want. You know? Well, if you had parents that did that for you and didn't make you feel guilty about it, but really gave it freely, then chances are you look at yourself and say, you know, I must be worth something. I must be worth something. If you were loved in that way and you have a sense that you're pretty special or you're unique, you're not alone, that you really belong, or that you are worthy in some way, then I'd say you got a pretty healthy self-esteem. You got a pretty healthy identity about you, right? But that's only part of the story. The other side of the coin is trustworthiness, right? What does trustworthiness do for us? This, you know, none of us is able to figure out ourselves in a vacuum. we are dependent upon relationship. We have to do relationship. We can't survive by ourselves. And so what happens is when we move into relationship, we're always asking questions like, is this going to be okay? You know, are you going to give me what I need? Am I going to be able to supply to you what you need? Are you going to be predictable? Are you going to be really nice to me this time and Miss Crazy the next time? You know, is this going to be predictable? Is it not going to be predictable? Are we going to be able to do business in giving to each other what we need and taking what we need? And can we be open with one another? Can we stand in front of one another totally unashamed and tell each other the truth? You know, that's because we deal with a lot of marriages, we deal with a lot of affairs. And I can tell you the thing that's so devastating about the affair, it's not the idea that my spouse had sex with somebody. It's the lie. It's the betrayal of the loyalty. That's the dagger in the heart of trustworthiness, is that I thought that you were my one and only. And instead, you were giving that to somebody else. That's what's so devastating when you're talking about affairs. In other words, yeah, it has to be predictable, it has to be fair, and it has to be open. If we can't do that, then we say, it's not safe. It's not going to be okay. Well, here's the deal. You know, so this teaches you that your identity is okay. This teaches you that you're safe. Anybody here that grew up in a perfect household where you got all this, where all of it just felt warm and fuzzy all the time? Yeah, there's the situation is that we're raised by human parents. Certainly some of us came from better backgrounds than others, but none of us came from absolute perfect backgrounds. But here's the other deal too, is that just by fact that you're here, none of us grew in situations where we're totally bereft of love and trustworthiness. In other words, we got some of it or we wouldn't have survived. And does that make sense? But you know, here's the deal, is that when we get a violation of love or trustworthiness, that's the root of the pain. We don't know who we are, or we don't know that relationships are safe. That's what triggers us in our brain. We have 7 executive operating systems in our brain. That means that it's a semi-automatic reaction. Is that when something happens, we automatically react. 4 of those 7 automatic systems are dedicated to something we call fight and flight. When we're in pain, when we're under stress, when we don't know who we are, or we don't know that something's safe, there are a good number of us that are going to react like, put them up, and there's a good number of us that are going to say, I'm out of here. And sometimes we'll do both of those things, right? That's how it is with pain. The brain is a wonderful place, but it doesn't know the big difference between what's happening physically or emotionally. It doesn't differentiate those things out big time. You know, I was fascinated with the study that came out 2 years ago. You know, we take care of NFL players really well when they get injured. We usually do fMRI body scans on them to make sure they don't have concussions and things of that nature. So if they have a knee injury, they get a full body scan, right? Well, so we had pictures of people in pain, physical pain, of their brains. Guess what? Some guy had the wise idea of comparing those pictures of brains to people who were under emotional distress. Guess what? Same areas of the brain are being stimulated. Yeah, they look the same. In other words, when you're in pain, you react. You react. You're built to react. And even if that pain, whether that's a physical pain, whether that's a physical threat, or whether that's an emotional pain or emotional threat. Now, the question always comes up is that, you know, where did you learn this violation? You know, I'm saying it probably didn't start with your spouse. You know, for a lot of you, It probably happened in your family of origin, right? The family that you grew up in. Sharon and I will tell our stories a little bit later on, but you have to understand that situation, even if it wasn't perfect. You know, some of you come from a situation that was really, really hard, a physically abusive situation or a sexually abusive situation. Some of you grew up in a situation where somebody was just manipulative or was interested in their stuff more than they were interested in your stuff. I can tell you that it doesn't matter. Pain is pain in the world. When you feel it, it just hurts. And if it screwed up your identity or screwed up your sense of safety, that's just the way it is. Some of you grew up in pretty good families, and you say, hey, I don't think that I had any violation there. But middle school, that thing really screwed me up. Well, or I had a coach once, or I had a mentor once that had a big influence on my life. Yeah, we were still open to that when we were, maybe when we were little Schaefers up to 8 or 9 years old, we were doing okay. But then we started getting into more of the real world, and maybe peers attacked us, or they made fun of us, or they kept on ridiculing us, or maybe we had a coach that just wouldn't back off on us, or maybe we had a coach that said, that made us feel like we never could measure up or never please anybody. Maybe we felt like we were totally exploited by the situation we grew up in. So it may have been your family of origin, it may have been your peers or some mentor or something like that. And then some of us grew up in situations where maybe our family was pretty intact and maybe our growing up was pretty intact, but things weren't safe around us. You know, maybe some of us grew up in a situation of just abject poverty, where you never knew what the next thing was going to happen, or you didn't grow up in a neighborhood that was safe. Maybe you experienced a natural disaster. Maybe you had a business failure. Maybe I always think the folks down in New Orleans, for instance, they're still reeling from Katrina. Happened in 2005, but that's what they're still reeling from the fallout of what was going on. 2007, I guess. Well, somewhere around in there. When you get that kind of trauma that happens, somebody in your family gets murdered. Maybe somebody in your family gets shipped off. Maybe you experience some kind of trauma where you are severely injured. Maybe you are exposed to long-term lack of safety. Those are the types of things that can also wear into your being, wear down, and cause you just long-term pain. So what do we do with that pain? So you're not, I can tell you, you're not responsible for your pain. You didn't write your original identity, neither did you write your original sense of safety. Those things usually happen to you, and you usually learned about it while you were growing up, somewhere between ages 0 and 20, right? Does it make sense? Yeah, but remember, our brain is built in a particular way, that fight or flight. When we get in pain, we react, right? What if I don't know who I am? What if I don't know that people love me? Why didn't people love me? Well, one of the choices that I have, and this is a fight framework, is that people didn't love me because they're stupid. They're monsters. They didn't care. In other words, I blame them. It's all about somebody else's fault. That's why I was not loved. Somebody did me wrong, and go tell it to them. Because they're the problem. I'm not the problem. I was just an innocent bystander. But I can tell you what, they're the problem now. People that blame, man, they're angry, right? They're kind of retaliatory. They always want to punish. They're pretty demanding. They're pretty sarcastic. You know, sarcasm is just a nice way to express anger. Well, it's not very nice either, is it? When you kind of get that kind of anger, retaliatory, demanding type behavior, wow. And by the way, when these when these people withdraw, they usually withdraw to punish you. You know, you did wrong. I just want you to know that. I'll talk to you again when you get the message. You know, that may be 3 weeks, it may be 3 years. We'll just see how long it takes you to figure out what you screwed up, right? You know people like this? Oh, I hope so. The other extreme of that, you know, of why was I not loved? Why do I not know who I am? Is that I shame myself. I'd say, it goes something like, why was I not loved? I'll tell you why I wasn't loved. Because I'm not lovable. There's something wrong with me. I'm bad. My parents were right in the way that they treated me. I don't deserve to have people love me. They beat up on themselves just enormously, you know. So, you know, typically if I shame myself, I'm always kind of just battering myself with negativity. I have a sense of hopelessness. I have this sense that, oh, please, won't you come and take care of me? Sort of needy, right? And I, you know, if I'm in that framework, I'd say it, I whine a lot. You know, people don't love me. Well, God loves you. Yeah, I know. I know God loves me, you know. And by the way, when I withdraw, when I'm a shamer, when I withdraw from people, it's with the secret hope that you'll come and get me. Won't you please come and get me? Please, please. If you do, it won't do any good, but I want you to come and get me anyway. Try to make me feel better, please. Right? Anybody in here like that, maybe? Oh, I hope so. What do we do if things aren't safe? Well, if we're a fighter, right? We say, if things aren't safe, well, I'll just control everything. I'll just make sure that nothing is out of my control. Here's the deal. I don't depend on anybody. I don't need anybody. I may prefer to be around a few people, but I don't really need anybody. In other words, in relationships, it's still a give and take. You know, I give something for the good of the relationship, and then you give something, and I take that for the good of the relationship. That's what keeps us going. Well, controllers just say, no, I will only give. I don't need anything from you. All I need from you is to do exactly as I say, right? Do it my way, and you'll be okay. And of course, the problem with controllers is you can never do it their way because you're not them. So what do? You know, well, they're really performers, right? They're Johnny on the spot. They're very perfectionistic, right? You know, in Western culture, we call this healthy, right? Because they pay their bills. They show up on time. They're good church members. But if you live with one, man, you know there's no pleasing them. They're also very judgmental. They're very anxiety driven. They're always looking, they're not only looking out for themselves, they're looking out for the 35 danger zones of how people can really get in their way. I always kid about this. I'm married to a controller. That's her main deal, you know, is that. So I really know when Sharon's under stress, when I wake up in the morning and she has been up, she's obviously been up in the middle of the night and she's made herself a list, you know, of 20 items to do, right? I know she's overwhelmed with stress when there's a list of 20 items to do and then next to it is a list of 20 items that I'm supposed to do. Right? She's controlling everything around because that's how I keep myself safe. I keep myself safe by making sure that every I is dotted and T is crossed. There's nobody in here like that, right? I see the smiles, so I assume that there's a significant portion of you. But that's not the only thing, right? There's a fight response. There's also a flight response. What do I do when things aren't safe? I run. That's right, I escape. I leave. I just get the heck out of there, right? I can't take it. I get overwhelmed. It just unravels me. I'll never forget the first time that I was, this really came into focus for me. I was a young counselor. I was dealing with a woman, and she had some real struggles going on. I mean, she was being evicted from her apartment. Her lights had already been turned off. She was, and she'd just gotten through telling me about how her kids needed shoes. She had three kids, and they all needed shoes. And she was telling me the story, and she kind of got this lost look on her face, and shook her head, and she said, "I'm going to Las Vegas." And I had the same reaction. I kind of chuckled, like, yeah. And she did. She was serious. It wasn't because she had the idea that Las Vegas was going to solve anything. She knew that when she came back in 4 days, that exact same situation, and only worse, was going to face her. But her idea was, I can't take it anymore. Therefore, I'm checking my ticket, and I am out of here. I'm checking out. Well, people check out in various ways. Sometimes they actually leave. You know, if you're on this light end of checkout, sometimes we think of acceptable ways to do that, kind of light end checkouts, like I'll sleep too much when I'm under stress, or I'll shop too much, or I'll eat too much. When we start getting more serious about it, we start drinking too much, drugging too much, maybe porning too much, right? If we get really deep into escape, then we start disassociating. We just have a psychotic break. We just can't think about it anymore. And of course, what you realize is that kind of drama in your life where you just check out of life, it creates a lot of chaos for those around you. They can't handle that kind of irresponsibility. It creates a lot of lack of safety for them. Does that make sense? Now, here's the really good news. You may do one of these. You may do two of them. You may do three of them. Or as we say out in California, you may go for the whole enchilada. You may do all four of them, right? Yeah, it doesn't make you good or bad, the number of coping mechanisms you have. But here's the deal. Modern psychology has focused way, way too long. What do they do with people that, for instance, get angry too much? Now, if I'm being honest with you, what we've done is we try to get them in touch with themselves and shame them a little bit. Aren't you ashamed of yourself? Maybe we'll incarcerate you. Maybe that'll make you think about doing it. What do we do with people that we shame themselves too much? Well, traditionally, we want them to blame someone else. We get them mad. We get them angry at people that it wasn't their fault, in other words. What do we do with controllers? We try to make them less controlling. What do we do with people that are escapers? We try to make them more controlling. This is changing furniture on the Titanic. As long as we're trying to move people around on these coping mechanisms, it does no good. This is where the pain exists, gang. Unless you address your pain, unless you learn how to address that sense of identity, that sense of safety, that emotion is what's driving this kind of behavior. And lest you think that some of these behaviors are okay, let me tell you, all four of these behaviors actually destroy love and trustworthiness for someone else. You cannot be angry and do anybody else's identity good. You cannot shame yourself and do your own identity any good or anybody else's. You cannot control and be safe. Let me say that again. You cannot control and make it safe for someone else. And you certainly can't escape and be safe. Right? Here's the problem, and for most of us, this didn't start with our spouse. Our spouse just is a master at tying into this violation, is cueing it off. But it didn't start with them. We usually carried it into our relationship long before we met our spouse.
Yeah, and what's interesting, and one thing that we find so much is how scriptural this is in the concepts of what we want to look like. In, you know, as Terry's talking about blaming, shaming, and controlling and escaping, you know, would we say that those things are Christ-like? No, they're not. you know, and one thing that we've really, really want to emphasize to you is withdrawing and just going away in a relationship so you don't cause problems in a relationship is just as destructive as being aggressive in a relationship. Now, a lot of times people think, well, you know, we've taught this concept of a timeout, or, you know, you need to get away from the relationship or something like that. But the problem is when you take a timeout and you don't go back to it and you don't solve those things, then you're still creating problems. So if I can turn through scripture with one hand, when we think about the scriptural principles and what we think about, if we're say, are these behaviors things that we want to have, we would say no. And if I were to ask you what some of those scriptures were, some of you would probably come up with some of the scriptures that I think about. I think about Ephesians 4 and Colossians 3, Romans 12, scriptures that talk to us about this whole idea of taking off the old self and putting on the new self. You see, this is another thing that's really great about marriage, is because I learn more about what it means to have a relationship with Christ when I'm in relationship with other people, because if I'm doing these behaviors, I'm not living in the newness of what Christ has asked me, has told me I can do. And I just want to read some of this scripture to you and how we live in the newness of Christ. And it's in Ephesians 4. And it starts with verse 20. But it's not that way that you've learned Christ, assuming that you've heard about him and were taught in him as the truth is in Jesus, to put off your old self as the truth is in Jesus, and to put off the old self which belongs to your former manner of life and is corrupt through deceitful desires, and to be renewed in the spirit of your minds, and to put on the new self created after the likeness of God in true righteousness and holiness. So the last time you had an argument with your spouse, would they have said that you responded to that argument with true righteousness and holiness? Therefore, having put away falsehood, let each one of you speak the truth with his neighbor, for we are members of one another. Be angry and do not sin. Do not let the sun go down on your anger, and give no opportunity to the devil. Let the thief no longer steal, but let him labor, doing honest work with his own hands, so that he may have something to share with anyone who is in need. May he who is angry not be angry anymore, and may she who is bitter not be bitter anymore. Oh, those last two verses aren't really there, are they? I stuck those in. But this is the reality. When he says a thief should steal no longer, he's also saying if we're carrying bitterness or anger, we should be bitter and angry no more. If we're screaming and yelling, we should not be screaming and yelling anymore. Therefore, having put away falsehood, to each one of you speak the truth with his neighbor, for we are members of one another. Let no corruptive talk come out of your mouths, but only what is good for the building up, as fits the occasion, as it may give grace to those who hear. Let all bitterness and wrath and anger and clamor and slander and blame and shame and controlling and escaping behavior be put aside. You know, you guys have had that experience. I know you've had the experience because I've had it a lot myself, is I yell at my kids or I get angry at Terry or I do something that I don't like about me, and I say to myself, I'm never going to do that again. I am never going to do that again. And 2 hours, 2 weeks, 2 days later, I find myself doing the exact same behavior that I've sworn that I will never do again. And what Terry and I have become to believe is, in order to do this thing of taking off the old self, is that we have to know what it is that we need to take off. Because if we don't know what we're taking off, we can't take it off. And so we have to begin to learn that about ourselves. And Terry and I are going to tell you a little bit about our stories so we can give you an illustration of what it means to learn about what it is that you need to take off. I was actually born in Burbank, California. I was the fourth of four children, the only girl. A prized possession. When Terry tells my story, he says I was like Simba in The Lion King. And I don't remember that story, that family I was born in too much, but I don't know what my parents carried around between 1957 and 1960, but we have some incredible film of my family. My dad and my brothers playing baseball, my dad and my brothers playing football, my dad and my brothers playing tennis, my dad and my brothers at Disneyland, my dad and my brothers at the beach, everywhere. And then somewhere in the film, in rolls the stroller, and there she is. And the brothers run over and they kiss on her and they love her. I was deeply, deeply loved. And you never see my mom. She's not in any of the film, and you know where she is. She's right behind the camera, right? But I don't remember that family very much because in 1960, my dad, who was bipolar — we didn't know about bipolar in 1960, by the way. For those of you that don't know what bipolar disorder is, bipolar disorder, people have times of depression and they have times of mania. Creativeness, positive things. So I think part of the reason my dad was successful in the advertising business was because he was bipolar and he was very creative. But about three times in his life, he hit a depression that he couldn't get beyond. And in 1960, he hit a depression that he couldn't get beyond, and so he decided to solve that problem by committing suicide. That left my mom and four children in Southern California. She'd grown up in Oklahoma, and she didn't think she wanted to raise four children in Southern California. So she packed us up, and she moved us back across the country to Amarillo, Texas. That's the accent. And we kind of got settled in, and life appeared to be getting normal a little bit. I don't remember much about that time. I was three. But my oldest brother, Ben Bruce, started not feeling very good one day, and they kept him home from school for about two or three days. And he came to my mom, and he said, you know, I think there's something more wrong with me than just the flu. Something's not right. She called the doctor. The doctor set up an appointment to meet him at the hospital the next morning. But unfortunately, they never got there because Bruce died of acute leukemia in the night. So in a period of under a year, we lost my dad, and then I lost my brother, Bruce. And my mom is a pretty amazing person. I have fun memories in my childhood. I have some things that make me smile and make me laugh. But then again, in 1970, my oldest brother, then David, was a student at the University of Oklahoma in Norman, Oklahoma. And he and his date didn't come home one night, and that wasn't like David at all. So my mother and my brother John and I got in the car and we drove to Norman, Oklahoma, and by the time we got there, they'd found out that my brother and his date the night before had been murdered and left in his car. So from 1960 to 1970, three very sudden tragic deaths. But two good things happened in 1970. One was that some friends of mine told me about a relationship with Christ, and I think I'd always heard about a relationship with Christ, but they told me about a relationship that was with an eternal God that could not die, and that sounded pretty good. And I don't think everybody has to have a time or a moment where they commit their life to Christ. I think some of us, it happens over a period of time, but I have a time and a moment in front of 2816 Bowie Street in Amarillo, Texas, when the stars were as bright as they could be, that I said, God, I need you, and I need a relationship with you. That same year, there was a young man by the name of Terry Hargrave, who a good friend of his named Randy Leiter took him out to play golf. And Randy asked Terry if he knew what it meant to be a believer, and Terry said, I have no idea, and Terry will tell you some of his story. And Terry came to know the Lord in that same kind of way on a golf course that same year, and that's the same year, the next year, we ended up in eighth grade English together. Well, Terry and I, he was cute. He got in trouble a lot. And I was kind of attracted to him, but he started going steady with my best friend, so I solved that problem. I started going steady with his best friend. So we hung out a lot together, and Terry and I weren't necessarily romantically attracted to each other, but we were very good friends. And for 2 years, the four of us hung out together a lot, And then Chuck and Tanya, who were the oldest children in their family, had to be home on time. And Terry and I were the youngest in our families. We didn't have to be home on time. So we'd hang out together a little bit more. And then Chuck and Tanya broke up with us, and we moved on to greater and greener pastures, and Terry asked me out. And on the third date, Terry looked at me and he told me that he loved me and he wanted to marry me. And I was 16 years old, and that was just a little too much for me. So we have about 8 years after that. We have about 8 years after that of what we call dating hell. I cannot tell you how many times I broke up with Terry Hargrave. I broke up with Terry Hargrave so many times, I honestly can't tell you how many times I broke up with Terry Hargrave. But always for a good reason, right? My favorite reason being, one night we were at some friend's house and he ate 3 hamburgers, and I thought that was too much. What's a girl to do? You know, you got to get out of a relationship like that. So, I broke up with him. This happened so much so that the night that we got engaged, we were not dating. You know what you do when you come home for your college senior Christmas break? You know, you're in everybody's wedding, or at least you were then. The marrying age has gone up since then. But we were in 3 weddings together senior year. I'd broken up with him in August, and so it was December, and we were in 3 weddings together, and he looked really fabulous in that tux. And he played the guitar and sang at 2 of the weddings, and so I called him back. I always called him back. It was nice of him. But I called him back and I said, come on over and let's talk. And so he came over at 8 o'clock, and at 4 o'clock in the morning, he said, we either need to get married or we need to get out of each other's lives. He said, we're destroying each other's lives. He tells the story different. But anyway, and I said, okay, I'll marry you.
How romantic.
How romantic. to which he said, you need to go wake your mother up and tell her what you just told me, because if you don't wake your mother up and tell her that you just told me you'll marry me, you'll change your mind before tomorrow morning. So I woke my mother up at 4 a.m. and I said, Mom, Terry and I are going to get married. And she said, you don't want a person to sleep, do you? Which was kind of how almost everybody reacted to us. Terry and I are getting married. Oh. They've been watching us destroy each other's lives for years. But you know why I didn't want to marry Terry Hargrave? What was the reason? Scared. What was I scared of? That I'd lose him. I didn't know that at the time. This is going to be a harder thing to say with Hallie Ann sitting in the room. We also went to our OBGYN and asked him if he would tie my tubes when we were trying to figure out birth control, because we didn't want children. Why did I not want children? They just might die. I didn't know that. I didn't know that at 21. I didn't know that at 18. I didn't know that at 19. I was breaking up with Terry Hargrave for really good reasons, right? So that's what I brought into our relationship. And you know that you knew the answer to my question. I told you my story in six or seven minutes. You knew the answer to that. So let me ask you another question. If I were to ask you the question, what emotional response do you think is one of the most difficult feelings for me? If I get any kind of feeling of what, do you think is going to be really scary for me? Anxiety, but what would make me feel anxious? Loss. Anything that makes me feel in any way that I'm going to be alone in any way is terribly terrifying to me, okay? So if I have any feeling of anything that goes on that makes me feel like you're going to leave me in any way, that kind of shoots me over to that control issue, you know, that Terry was talking about, and we'll talk a little bit more about that. But you know that about me from me telling you my story. When I say being alone or being abandoned is another word that's really difficult for me, anything that makes me feel abandoned in any way is very unsettling to me. Do you understand that? You get that. You get that about me. What else might be a really unsafe feeling for me. Oh, I just said it. An unsafe feeling for me is anything that makes me feel unsafe in any way. So a couple years ago on the Arab Spring, when Hallian calls and says, "Mom, some friends and I, we want to go to Morocco." You want to go where? You know, anything that makes me feel that somebody in my life is going to be in a place that's going to be uncomfortable or unsafe in any way, I want to move into control. I remember when I was pregnant with Peter, Terry was leaving a job and they wanted to give him a, there's the food, I think, or something. They wanted to give him a hot air balloon ride. I just couldn't let him get on a hot air balloon when I was pregnant and I had a small child. So these things, anytime I feel these things, these emotions, I know, I've learned about myself, those are the emotions that I respond to the fastest. And you guys understand that about me. That's easy for you to see. Now, I've already, Terry's already confessed my sin, but, you know, I truly believe that if I can just get everybody around me to do what I need them to do, I'm going to be fine. Right? It works that way. So when I feel any kind of sense of pain, of aloneness or unsafety or anything like that, I move immediately to try to control the situation and make everything okay. If control doesn't work, then I step over to this next step and I can get really critical. Now, the reason that critical works next is because if I can be critical of you and tell you why you're being such a jerk and why you need to do what I need you to do and why you're being inconsiderate or everything else, if I can get really critical of you, then you just might fall back in and do for me what I need you to do, which puts you back under my control, which works really well. So that's a little bit of my story and how my background and past, you know, I was dearly loved by my family, but it was life situations and circumstances that crept in and made me feel unsafe or alone. And my coping mechanisms make sense when you know my story and what that looks like.
Yeah, my parents did a lot of things right. Okay, I was the fourth of four children. They did a lot of things right, but unfortunately, they grew up in physically abusive households where they didn't get much love. In fact, their goal in their families was just to escape their families. That's why they got married at a very young age, and they didn't know how to do much better than what was done for them. And so they carried that physical abuse right into my family also. And, you know, unfortunately, there were a lot of times that were out of control between 0 and 8 in my household. I mean, I remember a whole lot of times that were out of control. But for me, when I was 8, was the absolute worst thing. Because when I was 8, I decided, you know, nothing about my family looks like the kind of family that I want. I'm totally incompetent, not only in my family group, but also at school, in my neighborhood. I don't belong anywhere. In fact, here's the real truth. I was scared that no one loved me. No one wanted me. Well, I was depressed, right? And I handled that in a very careful way. I went into my family's bathroom. I pulled out one of my father's double-edged razor blades and pulled up my sleeve and carefully sliced into my forearm. Because even at 8, I knew if I cut my wrist, I'd really be in trouble, right? Well, you knew what I was looking for, right? I was looking for some proclamation that my parents really did care for me. Terry, you know, we'll get you this help, or why did you do such a thing? We want to love you. We care for you. But what happened, and it so discombobulated my mother that when she discovered what I'd done, my mother was the one that discovered me. She grabbed my skinny little arm, my bloody arm, up and held my wrist up to her face so I was dangling in the air. And she took the razor blade in the other hand and she held it to my wrist and she said, "If we're going to do the job right, this is where we need to cut you. She didn't cut me. But what I felt was this sludge of shame that started at the top of my wrist and just went all the way down through my body. Because I knew the truth then, right? The truth was is that not only was I not loved, I wasn't even wanted. And I made a determination that day. I remember going back to my room and thinking, I will never, ever, ever again venture out to ask somebody to love me. My one and only goal is to survive this family. Just the same way my parents' one and only goal became to survive their families. That's what it became about. You know, that was a terrible, awful day, right? But you can't live there forever, right? You try to figure out, and you know, so I'm one of these guys that just beats myself up terribly. I should have done something different. I keep it all inside. I withdraw a lot. I keep distance. But I couldn't live there, and so I started saying, maybe I'll try to perform my way out of this. Maybe I'll try to create an identity by the way I perform. You know, that started out by trying to be funny. I wasn't very funny, but I was cute. I was cute enough to get Sharon, right? So, yeah, and then I started seeing some possibilities that maybe I could achieve something academically. So I started working harder in school, paying attention, which was different. I was the first one in my family that got a degree without flunking out two or three times along the way. I thought, well, maybe I could, if I could get this kind of degree, maybe I can get another degree. And then I got another degree, and I thought, well, that didn't quite do it. I still don't know who I am. Maybe I'll get another degree, and then another. And then I finally gave up. Degrees aren't going to do it. Then I started thinking, maybe if I write a book. Then I started writing books, thinking, some of you that are performers that try to control what other people think about you through your performance, you know this. You're only as good as your last performance, right? You know, if I go do a class and 95% of the people think that I did terrific, what am I thinking about? The 5%, right? Oh, I did terrible. It's the 5%, you know. I'm only as good as my last performance. And you know that. That's a terrible tyranny. So once I can't do any more performing, I can't do any more withdrawing, I can't perform anymore, and somebody asks me to do something more, I get angry. I untap it and I let somebody have it because it's just not fair anymore. Well, you see how I kind of get set up for my life. I feel in my deep core, I feel unloved. I feel unwanted. And I always feel like I'm a failure or I'm not enough. That's what goes on in my heart. That's the message that I got when I was a kid. The way I try to cope with it is a particular way. It's what I call my three-step. I withdraw, and while I'm withdrawing, I'm shaming myself. That gets old quick, so I try to perform my way out of it to try to make sure that you think that I'm doing okay. And if that doesn't work, I get angry. Now, friends, I haven't done this three-step one time in my life. I haven't done it twice. I have done this three-step 10,000 times in my life. This is what we know about the old self that we've discovered through the brain research. I love it when Scripture teaches us something from 2,000 years ago that we confirm in brain research in the last 20 years. This is what we know, is that your brain, while it has a whole lot of possibilities on ways it can react, it chooses to react on what's easiest. And what's easiest is what it already knows. If you don't believe that, you know, if you're right-handed or left-handed, go home tonight and change hands that change the hand that you normally brush your teeth with, you know, and try that out. If you're normally right-handed, try brushing your teeth with your left hand. Find out how that goes. Now, your brain knows exactly what to do over here, but your brain doesn't automatically know what to do over here. Your brain has a lot of possibilities of a lot of different feelings it could have when it gets dysregulated, when it feels attacked, when it feels unsafe, when it feels your identity is threatened. But here's the truth. It chooses the easiest path. And the easiest path is what it's always known. I don't do this because it works. I do this because this is what I've learned to do over and over and over again. And it's drilled itself into my brain where I think it's my personality. I think it's as natural as falling off a log. I don't understand why everybody doesn't react that way. The truth is, though, is that it's just because my brain is used to doing it that way. My brain knows a particular pattern, the same way that Sharon's knows a particular pattern. Now, but when you look at this, does this seem reasonable for an 8-year-old when he feels unsafe and unloved and unwanted and feels like he's a failure? Does it feel reasonable to you that he would shame himself and withdraw and try to perform his way out of it and get angry? You don't look at me and say, whoa, you're crazy. Yet if you saw me in a fight with Sharon and I said, you just don't love me, do you? Well, okay, I'll just do everything in the house. All right, that'll make you happy. Yeah, yeah. And by the way, don't ever ask me for anything again. You'd look at me and say, well, that dude's crazy. But if you know my story, you'd say, no, that's not crazy. He's just doing the same thing. He's using an old technology for a new problem. Now, here's what the really painful part is. When I withdraw, what do you think that cues into O'Sharon here? Yeah, what do you think happens when I start performing silently and then finally just blow up in anger? Way makes it look like I am totally a crazy dude. And what do you think what goes on when she starts controlling my life as well as her life and becoming critical? It cues right into that stuff with me, right? Gang, this is what we call the pain cycle. Every time, I'm not saying that this is all you do in your marriage. I am saying this, though. You do this a lot when you're in conflict with one another, when y'all aren't right with one another, when you're not building each other up. You don't have 30 fights going on in your marriage. What you have is one fight using 30 different mechanisms. You can, I'm not fighting about the kids. I'm actually fighting about that I don't feel loved or I'm feeling like a failure. We're not fighting about finances. She's feeling like she's going to be unsafe and abandoned. Does that make sense? Yeah. If you start looking at what dysregulates you as a couple, then you start recognizing it is one thing. And isn't that interesting? Paul doesn't say, well, you know, if you're going to learn the way of Christ, you need to weed out those 30 things that really screw you up. What he says is, if you're going to learn the ways of Christ, you need to set aside, take off the old self. Well, if you don't know what this old self is, you're going to have a hard time taking it off. If you can find out what this is, then you have hope. You have the ability to say, ah, I can slay the dragon. Because it's not 30 things, it's just one central thing that you need to start queuing in on to get it. Does that make sense? Now, Sharon and I have this in our relationship. We're both marriage and family therapists. We've been at this marriage thing for 35 years, and you know what? We're still doing this. Less, but we're still doing it. Well, your deal is that you still have that old self hanging around you also. We want to help you tonight figure out what that old self is so that we can find out what the antidote is to love heals. How do you heal that